Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today's show is about the European economic crisis. First up, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the economist Michael Taft with an in-depth look at the Irish mess. And then at the bottom of the hour, a return appearance by the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis to talk about the continuing crisis in his homeland and the larger continental dimensions of the Eurozone disaster. Since we've got a big helping of interviews coming up, there's time only for a few words of comment on the economic news. So why not a few more words about austerity in keeping with the theme of this show? Specifically, Britain's savage austerity plan, concocted by the new coalition government led by Prime Minister David Cameron and his Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne. It's not irrelevant to point out that both these men are of aristocratic origin, though in Cameron's case, his aristocratic lineage begins with the illegitimate offspring of King William IV and his mistress, Dorothea Jordan. Cameron is also the issue of a long line of financiers. All this is by the way of saying that they represent a long-standing alliance in Britain between aristocratic and financial interests. And despite their occasional pseudo-populist stances, it shows. Cameron and Osborne propose slashing spending by nearly 5% of GDP over the next 4 years. That's massive, on a scale no rich country has ever attempted. The British Tories are proposing to cut 500,000 public sector jobs, raise the retirement age, and hack away at other public services. According to the Institute for Fiscal Studies, a think tank invariably described as independent and respected, the overall impact will be quite regressive. The poorest tenth of Britons will lose almost 6% of their income, the middle tenth just under 4%, and the second richest tenth will take a hit of under 3%. And these estimates are based just on proposed tax and benefit cuts. They will also almost certainly provoke a deep recession, meaning that the total effects could be even harsher than these first estimates. But austerity is the way of the world these days. We're going to get a dose of it after this election, more on that in the coming weeks. Obama's Deficit Commission is slated to issue its report December 1st, safely after the election, so no one's really talking about it during this empty and vicious campaign season. You can be sure that Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security will be on the chopping block. Stimulus packages around the world in 2008 and 2009 saved us from going totally down the depressionary drain. With austerity now ruling the roost, I'm afraid we may be making closer acquaintance with that drain. On a bit less of a world historical note, Ariup, born Ariane Danielle Foster, of the great late 1970s band The Slits, died on October 20th at the age of 48. What a great band they were. In her honor and memory, a bit of their music. That was some of the song Typical Girls by The Slits from their album Cut. Their singer, Ariup, died a few days ago. Okay, now to the case of Ireland, one of the countries at the periphery of Europe in the midst of a savage economic crisis. Employment has contracted by about 13% and GDP by about 11%. Those numbers are twice as bad as what the U.S. has experienced. The budget deficit has expanded massively as the economy collapsed. About half the increase in the deficit can be traced to an extremely expensive bank bailout. More on all this now from Michael Taft, an economist with the joint Irish and British Union, Unite. Taft was born and raised in the U.S., but he's been in Ireland a long time, so you can hear traces of both countries in his accent. He also writes a blog called Notes on the Front. Michael Taft. All right, let's go back a bit to the 1990s when Ireland stopped losing population. People stopped emigrating and people started actually coming into Ireland. The country had something of a boom underway and got promoted to tiger status. Was that real or was that just an illusion?
Well, that part of our Celtic Tiger phase was real. We came out of the recession in the 1980s, assisted by a young labor force and our membership of the European Union single market. We also had very low tax rates, and the government, through its public agencies, went around selling the fact that we had ultra-low corporate tax rates. This induced a substantial number of foreign multinationals to set up shop here, and the most significant portion of that actually came from America. And so the multinationals setting up plants started hiring literally hundreds of thousands of people. And unique in the industrialized world was the fact that our manufacturing employment started rising, where it was falling in other more mature industrialized countries. So this rise of direct employment from foreign multinationals obviously gave rise to employment downstream. We were also assisted by a substantial amount of subsidies from the EU to upgrade our road network, our rail network, our infrastructure. And so an economy which had been in recession only 10 years earlier were starting to achieve growth rates which were just phenomenal, 8%, 10%. But eventually that started to plateau. And at about the turn of the millennium, around 2000, the Irish economy took another and what was to be a disastrous turn. A government came in and started slashing taxation levels, taxes, capital gains tax, more corporate tax rates being cut. They also provided huge subsidies to the property sector. And from 2000 on, we had a property boom. Classical boom where a lot of money was being invested into housing and residential housing and commercial housing, and it just got out of control. We still had very high growth rates, but it all had to do with property speculation. In fact, it got to such a level that our statistical office estimated that at one point one in every seven persons employed in the economy was employed in some occupation that was related to property, whether it was a construction worker, whether it was a real estate agent, an architect, a landscape worker, secretaries in mortgage broker shops, or whatever. And of course, like all property booms, it collapsed, and it collapsed big time. And it collapsed at just at the same moment that the international economy started falling, after the Lehman Brothers. And a severe problem for our banking system was they had borrowed billions from other banks throughout Europe and lent out money to these speculators, to developers, and all of a sudden those sites, those investments became worthless overnight.
Let's go back to the boom phase for a moment. The foreign investment, the plants that were set up, were these just assembly plants to get easy, cheap access to Europe, the mainland of Europe, or were there deeper roots in that? Did they source locally, do R&D locally, or was it just like a maquiladora?
No, you're right. I mean, it certainly was an access point into Europe. The fact that we spoke English was a benefit. But a large part of the work was sub-assembly line work. Multinationals would set up shop here at what would have been not low-skilled labor, but not necessarily high-skilled labor either. And certainly things like R&D, the marketing aspect of these corporations, those would have remained in their home countries. So we didn't get any skill benefit from the multinationals coming in. I mean, just to give you a background to that, the Irish economy since our independence, actually, can be read as one long story of a failure to develop a strong indigenous enterprise class, a strong class of Irish businessmen and businesswomen. They tried it in the 30s and it collapsed. They tried it in the 50s, it collapsed. And they even tried it in the 70s. Three major initiatives to give rise to a strong industrial and enterprise class that was of companies that was owned and managed by Irish men and women. The problem is that most successful Irish business people were successful through property or through the export of live cattle, which doesn't do a whole lot for an economy. And so therefore, when the multinationals came in, this was, you know, this seemed to be too good to be true. But even then, there were voices saying, you know, unless you build strong links with these multinationals, unless you get spin-offs, unless you develop a strong indigenous base, a native base, you know, this boom will, you know, it'll go on for a while, it'll bring you up to a certain level, but then it will stop. And that's exactly what happened. For instance, the American multinationals are very strong in the chemical and pharmaceutical sector. That makes up about half of our manufacturing export base. The problem is that they don't source locally. 90% of the inputs, you know, into their production process, they import. So we have no downstream businesses, if you will, sourcing into these companies. So when they ramp up their industrial production in order to meet new export orders, it's companies in other countries that benefit, not Irish companies. So they tried to graft a layer of foreign capital on the country without any roots. Now, I must say that the problem of a lack of a strong enterprise base has never gone away. A lot of us would be quite thankful that foreign investment is still coming in, but it is not a solution. You do not build a strong economy unless you build your own skills with your own people.
Is that some of the heritage of Ireland's long status as a British colony?
There would be a strong element of that. I mean, I could go back a long ways. But the fact is we never had an industrialization phase like other mature modern economies. In fact, at the end of the 19th century, I think 90% of our manufacturing export was Guinness, which is hardly a basis of building a strong industrial base. What happened was that large farmers were very dominant in the early part of the state formation. They were centered in the beef sector, and they were not interested in building a food industry. Obviously, I mean, we have great food resources. So you should be building, you know, you should be developing plants, you should be developing your own value-added production. But they weren't interested in that. They were more interested in selling it into the British market, which they had done for centuries. And so in that respect, our monetary policy always had to stay close to British monetary to British rates. And they dictated our monetary policy well into the 1980s. Until we entered into the initially the European exchange rate mechanism, and then finally into the euro. But that was a legacy we never developed industrially. Those vested interests benefited under the British rule, they still came to dominate Irish government, Irish policy, well into the 50s and 60s when there was attempts to break away. And that is something that has, you know, that has plagued even our food sector, even to this day.
And now, of course, Ireland's monetary policy is made in Germany, right?
That's absolutely correct. And the interest rate policy was not beneficial to Ireland and also to other what are called peripheral countries in Europe, Spain, Portugal, Greece. It wasn't compatible with our economies in 2001, 2002, and it won't be compatible with our economies when they start raising interest rates probably sometime next year, late next year, because interest rate policy, the euro policy, is really dictated by Germany and France, their economies.
I'm speaking with Michael Taft, who is a research officer with Unite the Union. Okay, so now let's come back to the present and the crisis. Ireland was, I guess, the pioneer of the practice of austerity at the periphery of Europe. How's the austerity plan going?
We are now entering into a second fiscal crisis. And for the last 10 days now, all the news has been dominated by the fact that the government is going to have to repeat the austerity, intends to repeat the austerity project that it started in 2009, 2010, because surprise, surprise, they realized that when you drive down an economy the way they did through public spending cuts and tax increases on low and average income earners, that you actually do not tackle the deficit. The deficit is now higher than it was than when the government started its austerity drive, because the economy has just literally collapsed. Investment has collapsed. Consumer spending has collapsed. Employment has collapsed. Now they are planning a second round of these austerity cuts to stretch out to 2014, the same amount. It's hard to grasp. I mean, it's hard to grasp exactly what the government expects to happen. Because if you take 14 billion euros out of a small economy like Ireland in 2 years and the deficit goes up, why do you expect taking another 14 billion euros out of the economy over the next 4 years that you're going to achieve some sort of fiscal stability? They have not got the fundamental, they haven't learned the fundamental lesson that fiscal stability, economic growth, and job creation are all part of, if you will, a trinity, are all part of the same process. They have absolutely ignored all other elements of the economy and have gone after an austerity drive in an attempt to bring down the deficit, and they failed, and they're going to do the same thing again, and they're going to fail again.
Well, the orthodox, of course, would answer that Ireland is up to its ears in debt and has no choice but to cut spending because it's not going to be able to sell bonds. It won't be, it's reached its borrowing limit, and lenders are just going to cut it off.
In one sense, that's correct, but let's take a step back and ask why that has happened. We were told, the Irish public was told, and the consensus was absolutely incredible. Even elements, unfortunately, of the left and the trade union movement reluctantly bought into the consensus. But we were told that if we took these spending cuts, if we took these tax increases, if we took cuts in public sector pay, social welfare and old age pensioners pay, if we, you know, took the tax increases, that this would resolve the problem. Now, a number of us, including my union, economic think tanks like TASC, and other economists warned that it would not resolve that problem. Now, we've had the austerity. We haven't had the result that was intended, and now we are on the doorstep of IMF receivership being frozen out of the international bond markets and contemplating another round of deflationary cuts that will just embed deflation into the economy and make and create a low-growth situation. And in a low-growth situation where job creation is minimal, there's no hope of reducing the deficit. It just cannot be done. It's an experiment that has not been tried since the Depression era.
It looks like Britain is about to embark on an even more savage round of austerity. Is that going to have an impact on Ireland?
It will have an impact on Ireland because some of the few native-owned export businesses that we have, especially in the food sector, our main market is still Britain, or certainly a significant market is Britain. If what the Tory-led government in Britain bring about through their spending cuts is lower growth, and I think there's a consensus that growth will be lowered because of this, because that's what happens when you cut public spending, you cut growth, that will make it harder for us to sell into that market. So one of the few things that we have benefited, for instance, was, you know, there was a currency depreciation that benefited us quite by accident in the recession. Now will be taken away, and so more sectors of the economy will be hit by what Britain is getting up to. Never mind the fact that nearly a million workers are going to lose their jobs in Britain because of this. 500,000 public sector workers and 500,000 private sector workers are going to lose their jobs in Britain. You know, that's going to have so many knock-on effects onto Ireland because we still have close economic links. For instance, tourism, it's a big sector in many parts of the country, but a large part of our market comes from Britain. You know, that's going to continue to remain sluggish as a result.
Is there a material or class interest behind this austerity in Ireland and, you know, even in Britain? The financial sector pushing this, bondholders, or is it some sort of ideological obsession of orthodox thinking? How do you explain the extremity of it?
Well, there's certainly an interaction of the two. I mean, one has to remember that Ireland is unique among European countries that has never elected a left-of-centre government. The parties that the two parties that have interchanged between leading the government were parties that emerged out of the Civil War. That became our division, rather than, say, through the industrial process, whereby you got, you know, social democrats and Christian democrats. Our division was based on the Civil War, and therefore, both parties being relatively conservative, one less so than the other, but, you know, sometimes not enough to make much of a difference. And our Labour Party, which would be the Social Democratic Party, has been historically weak and has merely just signed up to one or the other of the parties as a junior coalition partner. So there's never been a strong left tradition in Ireland, either at a political or at an intellectual level. So we entered into this recession with very few tools. I mean, we never produced a John Maynard Keynes or a Minsky or anything like that. In fact, most of our academic departments are academic departments are populated by people who studied in America and probably studied at the wrong departments, you know, because I know there's many good departments over there in America to study at.
Not that many, about four or five.
Okay, well, I don't think they came from there then. So what has happened is we've entered in this recession with few of the analytical tools by which you can construct an alternative to what has always been an orthodoxy. Ireland has always been a low tax, low public expenditure, low regulated economy. It has never had much time for public intervention. It has never had much time for a strong, dynamic public sector that works not only on its own, but also in partnership with a strong indigenous private sector, because we don't have the latter. And the multinationals, to be honest, are not really interested in our public sector. They're only interested in just low taxes and low wages. So that put us at a disadvantage from the very first. Yes. The banking interests have been able to load their debt upon the state. Now, I wish the labor movement could find a way for us to load the workers' debts upon the state. But, of course, I guess we don't have as much political power as the banks. But, of course, that's a story throughout Europe. European banks have been doing that, and now they're getting off very well, thank you very much. Many of the employers' organizations who represent the multinationals do not have much, as I say, much interest in the indigenous, the domestic economy. And to be honest, there have been people who have just gone along with the consensus because of a lack of an alternative. Now, there have been voices raised, there's no doubt. But, you know, I've been on a number of programs myself, and many of my colleagues in the trade union movement or among other progressives, and you are ridiculed, you are ignored, you are, you know, when you say that, well, no, by the way, if you actually increase investment in the economy during a period of slump, that will actually shorten the duration of the recession, that will lessen the impact, and you'll have a stronger economy coming out of the recession, better able to absorb the debts that arose during that slump. And this very, you know, and by the way, this is not a terribly left-wing message. You know, this is a fairly kind of orthodox Keynesian message. But even that is too much for the consensus over here. So it is ideologically driven, but it is driven because that there are the major interests in the economy, the financial interest, which of course is a major interest in all modern Western economies, but also the multinational interest in the economy. They're not all that interested in the progress of our domestic sectors, our public sector, or something like that. As long as they keep getting relatively skilled labor at a reasonable rate to produce goods and services for a very low profit, they're happy enough. And as long as banks can continue to operate once the state has subsidized them to get them out of the trouble, as long as they continue to operate for short-term shareholder interest, why are they interested in opening up the credit floodgates and making credit cheap and available to our enterprise sector?
This is the question I always ask when there's only a few minutes remaining, but what's a better way out of this pickle than the orthodox approach?
There's two things. I mean, there's two things that we can focus on. First off, the driving force in the Irish recession is the collapse in investment. Everything has flown from investment. Our investment levels now are back to 1998 levels. Now, I think you can probably imagine what would the American economy look like if all of a sudden investment was all the way back to 1998. The collapse in investment has been 120% of the collapse in the economy as a whole. So what the private sector is incapable of mounting a strong investment drive over the next few years, and because it's broken. You know, it's just incapable. And in the past, anyway, they've been very reluctant to invest in anything productive. They're more likely to invest in housing and property, which is not a way out of the crisis. So the state must intervene with a substantial investment program. And one of the benefits of years of neglect of our infrastructure, and if that sounds strange, I'm being a bit tongue-in-cheek here, but we have one of the worst infrastructural capacities in the industrialized world. So we need to increase both our physical and our social infrastructure, and what I mean social infrastructure is public services. We need to pump billions into that. We have the men and women to do that job. That in itself would generate the revenue and reduce the unemployment costs that would help close the fiscal deficit. And the one bright thing about an otherwise dismal economic landscape is that Ireland, the Irish government, has substantial cash and assets on hand. We have an equivalent of a sovereign wealth fund, which makes up about 15% of our GDP. We also have enormous cash balances arising from our Treasury agency that went off and saw the recession coming down the line and essentially borrowed more than we could possibly need. But they did so out of the fear that, the fear of what the recession might do to the island. So in one sense, it was actually a very far-sighted policy. But we now have another 15% of our GDP. One-third of our GDP is tied up in cash and assets. Let's access that for this investment drive. It wouldn't mean any extra borrowing. It wouldn't mean any extra taxation. We have the money already. But if we do this investment drive, we can get people back to work. We can improve our productivity. We can improve our efficiencies. And we can find a way out of this mess. That is how you bring a country back to fiscal stability.
But that's a distinctly minority view.
It is.
How is Michael Taft, an economist with the joint Irish and British Union, Unite? He writes about the Irish political economy on his blog, Notes on the Front. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about Greece and the broader crisis in the Eurozone. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News.
And here by the Seine, Notre Dame casts a long, lonely shadow. Now only sorrow, no tomorrow. There's no today for us, nothing is there for us to share but yesterday.
That was some of Song for Europe by Roxy Music, from back when Europe meant cafes and romantic languor, not economic crisis. My next guest is Yanis Varoufakis, who's been on this show several times before, to talk about the economic crisis in his home country, Greece. Yanis teaches economics at the University of Athens and has a piece on the Monthly Review website, mrzine.org, mrzine.org, on the Euro crisis. Yanis Varoufakis, and I know that's not really how you pronounce it in Greek, sorry. Welcome, Yanis. Before we start talking about the euro crisis, let's just get an update on what's happening in your country. How's Greece been doing since we last talked?
The crisis is intensifying. More shops are closing down. Unemployment is increasing rather fast. If I am to quote the trades unions estimates, it's gone up to 19-20% from 12%. The debt crisis is intensifying against what the government's wishful thinking would have you believe. And there is a general feeling that we are stuck in a rut and we're not getting out of it fast.
I notice you quoted the union's estimate of unemployment. Do you not have reliable labor market statistics in Greece?
No, we don't. And we don't because the unemployment data is compiled in conjunction with the rules according to which someone is, a worker is deemed eligible for unemployment benefit. So let me give you a very simple example. A student of mine that graduates and remains unemployed for a year is not counted because the only way you can actually be counted as an unemployed person is if you've been fired.
If the shop fails, they don't really count?
They don't count for a long while. At some point, they qualify for certain retraining schemes, which last a couple of months or so. And then if they can't find a job after that, then they are counted in the ranks of the unemployed. I don't think that anybody really disputes that the official data on unemployment underestimates the true figure.
And what about the other economic statistics? Do you have reliable data on income and product?
Yes. That has never been disputed. I think that it's as reliable as any such set of data might be. I have to grant the government that they have been trying to reform the statistics office and, in an attempt to create a new image for Greek statistics, they have been introducing the rules and regulations that govern Eurostat within the Greek statistical office. So the data is getting better, but it will take quite a while before we can be completely reliant and confident in them.
And getting back to the bigger picture, as the economy sinks, is the government engaging in austerity like the rest of peripheral Europe?
Well, look, the government, ever since sometime in May, we signed the Memorandum of Understanding with the International Monetary Fund, and in particular with the Eurozone, the government is in a straitjacket. It has effectively given up any right it had to fiscal policy. Monetary policy doesn't exist, hasn't existed for a while now because of the euro. So the government has effectively signed away its rights and privileges regarding the design and execution and implementation of any kind of serious macroeconomic policy.
Now, what about the other countries on the periphery that are in various stages of crisis, like Spain and Ireland? Ireland is several years ahead of Greece in its contraction. What is Ireland telling you now?
What Ireland is telling me is that the policies that are being pursued in Greece and imposed upon the Greek economy by the Eurozone and the IMF are about to fail. Now, let me remind you that about a year ago, when the Greek situation was becoming apparent to the world, the great and the good were lecturing Greece for not having reacted fast enough to the debt crisis that was mounting and for not having implemented harsh austerity measures like the ones that Ireland imposed upon itself without any foreign intervention like in Greece. So what we were effectively told is, had you acted as fast as Ireland did to introduce austerity, then you wouldn't be finding yourself in the mess you are in now. Look at Ireland. Ireland, where the blue-eyed boy or girl of the powers that be, of the Eurozone, of the ECB, of the IMF, they inflicted austerity upon themselves without being forced to do this by any outside organization. But the result is that the debt deflationary cycle is intensifying. The measures that have been imposed upon Greece for the Eurozone IMF loan, huge loan that was agreed in May, are just cut-and-paste measures from the Irish experience. They didn't work in Ireland. They're not going to work in Greece.
Yeah, Ireland's budget deficit is as big as it ever was, right? As the economy sinks, no matter how much they cut, the deficit just gets worse.
Well, isn't that a lesson that we've learned a very long time ago? When the crisis happens and the mountain of debt is created either in the public sector or in the private sector. In the case of Ireland, it was the private sector because it was the result of the collapse of the real estate market there and the accumulation of bad debts within their banking system. It doesn't matter where it starts from. When it starts and a recession begins in response, then cutting is only going to intensify that downwards process, and every attempt to squeeze the debt by cutting expenditure is simply increasing the debt. So, you know, this is something that I would have thought a 12-year-old would understand, but it seems to me extraordinary that this is something that catches the powers that be by surprise.
Now, what about the popular reaction? At first, there seemed to be some resistance in Greece. The Spanish, as a Spanish friend of mine says, engage in some sort of kabuki rituals of demonstration, but not much is coming of that. Of course, the French are setting the gold standard for the rest of the world in popular reaction, but what's happening in Greece?
As I had expected, well, look, in Greece in the summer, everything stops, including revolutions. So one would not have expected much revolt to occur in August, September. I would have expected already a series of strikes, crippling strikes, to have hit Greece. It hasn't happened. I did foresee that perhaps in a previous conversation, I think I mentioned that when a very serious recession hits, then a lot of people lick their wounds and stay at home and privatize their misery and despair and dreams. This is the phase we're in, but I do believe that the cauldron is picking up temperature, and at some point it will... the lid is going to be blown off again. Whether that will have any tangible effects or not, I'm not sure, but do expect to see again on your television screens images of violent demonstrations and conflicts with the police and all that. It's going to be happening. At the moment, I think that most of the population, the vast majority who are suffering the crisis, are effectively trying to come to terms with what is happening. But the great hope, I think, is France, as you mentioned. All good things start in France from the 18th century. And I think that this is where the game is going to be played, in the streets of Paris and in the connections between those streets and the various movements that are perhaps biding their time in places like Portugal, Spain, Greece, Italy, and so on.
In Spain, the unions actually helped tranquilize resistance, despite some public displays of resistance. In fact, they were tranquilizing it. What about the trade unions in Greece?
It is a similar situation. Greece and Spain are very similar in the sense that we have party-controlled trade unions. So, to cut a long story short, the official confederation of Greek trade unions is controlled by the Socialist Party, and the same party which is in government. Now, the unionists of the Socialist Party are very angry with the government, but they are caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, they are arguing the case against their own government. On the other hand, they can't really cut the umbilical cord that is connecting them to the governing party. So they are sort of caught in the middle, and the result is that they are being lambasted both by the more radical parts of the left and by the government and the reactionary forces, which portray them as a useless institution that serves absolutely no purpose.
I'm speaking with Yannis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. And now let's broaden the focus to talk about the euro crisis and your piece at MRZine. At first, this seemed like an American crisis when it first broke out, 2007-2008. It was our mortgage market and bad derivatives that were causing the rest of the world problems. But now Europe seems to be causing some trouble on its own. How has the global crisis taken on a European dimension now?
Well, look, at first, when Wall Street went into meltdown following the real estate crisis in your country, most people thought that this was an American disease and that it could possibly be contained on that side, on your side of the Atlantic. Soon, however, we realized here in Europe that our own banks were replete with the CDOs that were produced on the other side of the Atlantic. Most banks were swimming in them. So very soon, from Switzerland to France to Germany, one after the next of the banking institutions began to collapse. And just like in the United States, here in Europe too, it was the states and the European Central Bank that replaced all these ashes of what I call private money, because that's what the CDOs were. They were pieces of paper that were accumulating in the banks, and they were being traded and used as a form of private money that was fueling the inverted commas growth of the pre-2008 period. When those big pieces of paper, that private money, burnt out, public money, freshly minted public money, was pumped into the banks to keep them alive. And that created the sovereign debt crisis, the crisis of the public debt in Europe, to the extent that by, let's say, March, April, May last of 2010, we had our own credit crunch in Europe. And it was a crunch not so much of the interbank market, but of the bond market. And very soon, Europe came face to face with a reality. The reality being that the weak links in the euro chain were either going to have to break and be allowed to sink, or they had to be supported in some way. Unfortunately, the way that Europe tried to address this issue was effectively by delaying the moment of reckoning rather than coming to terms with it.
What about the contrast between the euro and the dollar, which in part means a contrast between the U.S. government and Europe? How do these different monetary and political regimes, the contrast affect the response?
Well, the dollar is a reserve currency. It's an international reserve currency, as we all know. So that gives a lot more degrees of freedom to the United, to Washington. Having said that, the euro, it represents a major conundrum, a major paradox, in the sense that we have a common currency, but we don't have a common fiscal and taxation policy. That means that all the imbalances within the regions of Europe, the states that belong to the eurozone, translate into chronic imbalances that cannot be ameliorated through some kind of recycling of the kind that you have in the United States. There is no such thing as an authority that can decide to deal with the mountain of debt, private and public debt, as a single problem homogeneously and to confront it head on. In the United States, in Washington, the president, the head of the Fed, the Treasury, can get together and possibly bring into the conversation some major Wall Street bankers and discuss ways of handling a major crisis of debt, both federal debt and the debt of the banks. In Europe, they couldn't do that. And instead, they created a new derivatives market in order to support the states, which effectively went under because of the collapse of the derivatives market. So you create a new problematic financial instrument in order to deal with the problems created when a previous problematic, highly toxic derivative went under. So this is what I'm saying, kicking the can down the road was the strategy of the Europeans, and I'm afraid that this is going to be haunting us for the next few years, because effectively what is happening is the crisis, the recession is deepening, and it's every person, every state on its own is not even a semblance of a common European economic strategy for exiting the crisis, and instead we have a beggar thy neighbor attitude by the surplus countries like Germany and Austria and Finland, who try to pretend that this is just a problem of discipline and some good puritanical belt-tightening will deal with the problem, when the problem is structural. It's got to do with the fact that we don't have a way of dealing with a crisis. There was never a mechanism for addressing a debt crisis, And the more we delay the creation of such a mechanism, and the creation of a mechanism that prevents some such crisis from happening, the more powerful the recessionary forces, and the greater the difficulty that Europe as a whole will be posing to the global economy.
Let's talk about a couple of things in a little more detail. First, the euro brings together countries, you talked a little bit about this, brings together countries that run huge trade surpluses or monsters of global productivity like Germany, with countries in the periphery that run big surpluses, deficits rather, and can't possibly keep up with German industry and its level of sophistication and productivity. What does that do to the coherence of the currency? This whole single currency project, did anybody ever think of that when they created the thing?
I think they did. I think that the people who actually, people like President Mitterrand of France and Helmut Kohl, the Chancellor of Germany, who were the architects of the euro, they knew that you cannot bind together disparate economic forces like Germany and France and Greece and Spain and Portugal and Ireland, bind them together with a common currency, with a common monetary policy, without also creating a second mechanism for ameliorating, addressing the imbalances that will grow and grow and grow. They knew that during a period of growth, when the whole region of the Eurozone is growing, the cracks will not show, they will not appear. It is possible to have growing imbalances between Germany and Greece, let's say, or Austria and Portugal, during a period when everybody is growing, without this becoming apparent and leading to a crisis. But the moment the arrow is reversed and from going up it starts going down, these cracks will get worse and worse and worse until something serious breaks. I think Mitterrand and Kohl knew that. But for them, back in the late 80s, early 90s, when they were planning ahead for the creation of the Eurozone, this is my theory, they must have been convinced that politically it was impossible to impose upon all these different countries not only a common monetary policy, but also a common fiscal policy and a common economic and growth plan. So they must have thought, we'll bind them together with a common currency. And when the crisis comes, in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they will be faced with a simple dilemma. Either introduce the missing link, the missing institutions, or break up the union. They were probably hoping that after quite a few years of having coexisted under the same currency, we will have grown to like it. And we will have grown to like it so much that instead of simply giving it up during a crisis, the Europeans would decide to cross the final bridge into a territory in which you have a common economic policy, not just a common monetary policy. Unfortunately, I think that our leaders of this day and age, President Sarkozy and Mrs. Merkel, are dwarfs compared to Kohl and Mitterrand. Kohl and Mitterrand were not politicians that I would have voted for. And it's not that I agree with the policies that they pursued, but they were far-sighted people, and they were not political dwarfs. Merkel and Sarkozy are here today, gone tomorrow. They have they bring to the problem the attitude of a corner store keeper, and they don't have the capacity to impose their political will on the political interests that brought them to power. And this, I think, is the reason why Europe, instead of using this crisis in order to move ahead and to create the institutions that were missing from the original design, rather than do that, we are now engaged in an inane, quite unproductive discussion about disciplining states that fall out of line regarding fiscal deficits and so on, pretending that the problem is one of discipline when it is a matter of design.
I'm speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. Well, and just when you need this farsightedness, Germany is getting rather ugly. You had Merkel complaining about immigrants in Germany the other day in very ugly ways, and now also Germans have been complaining about the burden of supporting Greece and other peripheral countries. Germany is really not living up to the role it should be if it wanted to lead the Euro project forward, is it?
And it's not just Germany, is it? If you look at President Sarkozy's attitude towards the Roma people, who were the victims of the Holocaust? Except, you know, it was the Jewish people and it was the Roma, primarily. And now we have a Europe in which racism is becoming a substitute for rational discussion. We're in a desperate juncture at the moment. I very much fear that the more our politicians are refusing to impose a collectively agreed political solution upon this debt crisis, each for his or her own reasons, the more we're going to be drifting into a kind of war of all against all, at least at the level of rhetoric. But for some people, the weakest links in the social chain, like the Roma, it's not just a rhetorical war. It means being hounded. It means being deported. For the first time, we've had a chancellor in Germany effectively alluding to some kind of racial profile that suits Germany better than some other racial profile. This is profoundly worrying. And it is for the first time that we had an expulsion of European Union citizens from one European Union country to the other, when the whole point about the European Union is that we don't have borders, and that no one can expel a German from Greece, a British person from France, or for that matter, a Romanian Roma from Paris. But we've seen that happening, and this is a direct repercussion of what happens when an economic crisis is not dealt with by political means, rational political means, collectively agreed, and instead it's allowed to drift into a war of all against all.
So, looking forward, the U.S. economy is hardly staging a vigorous recovery, but it's stabilized, and some things are pointing mildly up. It doesn't look like it's falling apart anymore. There are really no hints of that for much of Europe, are there?
Well, bits of Europe are doing reasonably well, as long as the United States is flooding the cosmos with liquidity, with quantitative-eased dollars. And while China is still hanging on its own little property bubble in Shenzhen and in Shanghai, bits and pieces of Europe are managing to keep their heads above water. Germany is still maintaining a surplus when it comes to manufactured goods, particularly capital goods, machinery, industrial machinery, to places like China. In July, they were celebrating that they had a very good month in terms of their trade with Japan. Now, Japan is moving in the wrong direction, and it's all hanging by a thread. To put it very briefly, the parts of Europe that are doing reasonably well are doing so on the basis of freeloading. Freeloading on the United States and on China. This cannot continue. The United States' recovery, as you said, is very flimsy. I don't know for how long it can be maintained, especially after your November midterms, when your country is going to probably become ungovernable. I do not know for how long China will keep bubbling along when 60% of GDP is accounted for by the construction sector. This is an abhorrent number. This is, to me, it sounds like a bubble waiting to go pop. Not pop, but bang. When the percentage of GDP which is accountable for by consumption, internal domestic consumption, is falling in China. And, finally, when these German and Austrian and Scandinavian surpluses, which allow these countries to imagine that they may get scot-free, that they may escape the crisis without addressing head-on the structural problems of the Eurozone, these surpluses, to a large extent, are surpluses vis-a-vis the rest of Europe. That is, countries like Greece and Portugal and Italy, the countries that are deficit countries, and which cannot maintain deficits like this in the current climate of a debt deflationary cycle. So the whole thing, which keeps some people in Germany and in Holland thinking that their current course may see them through this crisis and onto dry land, I think that this is more an exercise in wishful thinking than rational thinking.
So in your crystal ball, we're still on the way down.
I very much fear that we're nowhere near the end of the cycle that began in 2008. The currency wars that are now being discussed are simply a manifestation, a kind of signal that the underlying economic forces at the global level have not managed to return us from the abyss, from the edge of the abyss, to a path that we can tread safely. I very much fear that your own recovery may end up being so fragile that a double dip will become fact within the next 6 months. Europe is the weakest link in the sense that we have proven both incapable of dealing with our own internal European financial crisis, and also because of that inability to deal with our own situation rationally, or with anything approaching a modicum of rationality, we're getting in the way of any kind of global agreement that might avert a nasty turn of events at the global level, one that will simply see 2008 repeated in a different shape and form.
I've been speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. You can find his piece on the Euro crisis on the MRZine website. That's MRZine.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, live in the KPFA studios. Let's go out with this newish song from Best Coast. I read on the internet the other day, in an article on how to pick up hipster chicks, that they really like this band. Till next week, bye.
I can't do anything.